Welcome to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. We start today's program on the edge of the Everglades, where it ends. I'm in Florida Bay. This is where the water from the famed River of Grass slips quietly into the Atlantic Ocean, mixing fresh and salt water together, creating a unique environment for fish and plants. It's also at the end of hundreds of millions of dollars of investment that's being spent redirecting the water of the Everglades. That water and spending begins about 150 miles north from here, Lake Okeechobee. The lake collects the water flowing south, from the headwaters to what becomes the Everglades here in South Florida, some of which winds up here in Florida Bay. The water north is held back by the Hoover Dyke. That mound of dirt started as just a series of small levees helping keep Lake Okeechobee out from a growing agriculture industry. But two deadly hurricanes, especially the 1928 storm, pushed the lake waters over the levees, killing thousands of people. The federal government stepped in the late 20s and built the Hoover Dyke, protecting what has become a multi-billion dollar agriculture industry focused on sugarcane. But it also includes a little bit of winter vegetables and sod. The dike also stops what had been the regular flow of water 150 miles south to here, the Florida Bay. This is where the fresh water from the Everglades is supposed to spill into the Atlantic Ocean. The bay's waters are supposed to be blue and fill the dips and divots between the southern end of the mainland peninsula and the islands of the Upper Keys. But here in Florida Bay today, a still day on the water, it has an amber hue to it, thanks to dead seagrass. Between Florida Bay and north to the Hoover Dyke lie millions of acres of marshes, mangroves, and hammocks, wildlife and plant life, canals and roads, cities and towns, modern South Florida carved out of the Everglades. Billions of dollars have been and are supposed to be spent on fixing, cleaning, and protecting this area. Billions of taxpayers' dollars, billions of dollars of economic activity from agriculture to fishing, hospitality to real estate. Coming up on this program, we will tour this bay under my feet, Florida Bay, with scientists examining a growing ecological and potential economic disaster just under the calm surface. We will walk the Hoover Dyke 150 miles north from here, hearing about the millions of dollars being spent on shoring up the earthen dam, protecting people and products below it. And we'll hear about the bill to pay to restore the Everglades. The tab has doubled in the past 15 years. Who pays for that and why? What are taxpayers exactly buying? What's the return on investment for taxpayers that they're making more than 100 years after Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Broward pledged to drain what he called the pestilence-ridden swamp and make the empire of the Everglades? All that's coming up when the Sunshine Economy continues. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy in the Everglades. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. This is the sound of what's holding back Lake Okeechobee from South Bay in Palm Beach County as workers finish building a new culvert in the Hoover Dyke. It's the barrier helping protect billions of dollars of homes, businesses, and farm fields. It's a temporary cofferdam. On the other side of these sheets of corrugated steel are the waters of Lake Okeechobee. The source of water for the Everglades Agricultural District and the multi-billion dollar ag industry in western Palm Beach County. It's also the historic source of water for the Everglades ecosystem, water that now finds its way to the east and west coasts of Florida. And when the lake level rises like it did in December and January, a lot more of that water finds its way out a lot faster and a lot dirtier, hurting the rivers, wildlife, and tourism businesses. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is responsible for the lake level and for the bowl of dirt, rocks, and shells that holds it all in. The Hoover Dyke surrounds the lake and dates back to its presidential namesake. Since 2007, about $700 million has been spent fixing, replacing, and rehabilitating the dyke.
Okay, so we're just going to run through quick safety rules.
The first stop at one of the construction sites along the southern rim of the dike is the office trailer for a safety briefing.
Hard hat, safety glasses, probably not.
Stay on the paths, watch your footing, hard hat, safety glasses, and the reflective orange vest. My trail running shoes were a little suspicious, though, among the steel-toed work boots of the workers. But the safety manager let me in as long as I stayed with my escorts.
We were at what used to be called the C4A culvert, a structure under the Hoover Dyke that's used to direct water to the agriculture fields below. This particular culvert is just off Highway 27 as it bends west toward Clewiston. If you drive by, you can see where the dike has been scooped out, and the lake waters are held at bay by those sheets of steel allowing the construction of this new culvert. It's a $12.5 million project among the $700 million rehabilitation plan.
Michael Weiner, I'm project engineer for the Army Corps of Engineers.
He's also former active duty who now lives in Wellington and oversees the contractors working on the dike. Also with me this day was John Campbell.
I am one of the public affairs specialists with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Jacksonville District.
Now there are 26 of these culverts that will be replaced along the dike. 18 of them have been funded and work is underway. 8 more still need to be designed and Congress still needs to okay the spending before they can be replaced. When they're exposed, it's kind of a barbell type structure with walls on either end. One will be underwater in Lake Okeechobee, the other wall will be on the dry side of the dike. And in between,
you see this long concrete structure, very linear looking, and it's a barrel structure. It has 2 tunnels inside of it, and that will eventually be where the water passes from the lake or to the lake.
We're inside what they call the barrel of a 2-barrel structure here at this culvert. It's shaped like a square. It's about 200 feet long, and at the floor, it's 4 feet above sea level. Once this entire structure is done and the $12.5 million investment that it takes to finish it up, there'll be about 25 to 30 feet of earth on top of this structure. And on top of that will be the very height of the Hoover Dyke after the rehabilitation project is completed.
These culverts are not designed to control the level of the lake. They're too small to help drain the lake level when the water rises too high, which is actually a lower level today thanks to Hurricane Katrina. After that storm and the criticism the Corps received for its levee program, Lake Okeechobee's maximum level was reduced, and the Corps' spending priority for fixing the dike focused on reducing the risk of a breach. Again, John Campbell with the Corps.
And so with that philosophy in mind, we identified these water control structures, these culverts. They had a lot of erosion. A lot of them dated back to the 1930s as well. So those were seen as the greatest risk to the dike. And so now, over the past few years, we've been focusing almost exclusively on constructing and replacing these 26 culverts that we've identified.
When it comes to the dike and the Corps' management of it and the lake waters behind it, it's safety first, then water management.
We believe that certainly we'll have more flexibility in how we manage water. I think it's a conversation we need to have with stakeholders, the partners at the Water Management District, the environmental community, the farmers in the area. All of those involved stakeholders, I think we want to hear from in the next couple years once we start a formal study on what we think the water or what everyone thinks water management should look like in the lake.
Much of that lake water, as it has for years, is directed east and west, not necessarily south, through the high-value Everglades Agricultural District and eventually into the greater Everglades area. That is the 15-year-old promise of the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. Still to come, where that fresh water is needed to feed the environment and economy of the Florida Keys.
It's very difficult to watch the deterioration of Florida Bay leading to a deterioration of our fishery and then still try to be optimistic about the future. This makes it very difficult for us to make a living.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy in the Everglades. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. It's a slow troll north out of the Angler House Marina in Isla Mirada before we can pull away from the mangroves and the horizon of Florida Bay spreads out in front of us. The boat points toward a channel in the shallow bay. It's deep enough to allow the captain to plane up. And we're on our way north into the waters of the Everglades National Park. Small keys with names like crab, pollock, and dump dot our zigzag journey from basin to basin deep enough to allow us to go fast. We're on our way to look under the water, look for evidence of what happens when the bay at the bottom of the Everglades doesn't get enough water. On a sunny day, as we move further north toward the mainland, the water changes color. First, it's an amber hue, then a greenish tint. Evidence, Stephen Davis says, could be algae growing thanks to dying seagrass at the bottom of the bay. Davis is a wetland ecologist with the Everglades Foundation.
You know, you can see that the water has a color to it. Typically, water out here is crystal clear on a calm day like this. You don't get any of that green color that we're seeing here. That might just be a function of the intensity of the light, but to me it suggests that we might be getting an algal response to the nutrients made available by the dead grass and the fact that it's been clear and relatively sunny the last few days. So this concerns me a little bit, and we'll have to look at how the water quality changes over the next few weeks.
The clear waters and expansive underwater seagrass meadows of Florida Bay are iconic images of the Florida Keys. The bay is on the receiving end of the Everglades watershed. As our southernmost reporter Nancy Klinger reports, the bay's environmental and economic connections with the Everglades are both essential and threatened.
Tad Burke has been a fishing guide on Florida Bay for more than 30 years, but he's known the bay even longer.
I spent a large part of my growing up in the Keys, yes indeed.
Fishing?
Yes. Most of the time, all there was to do is be on the water, so that's what we did, and got boats before cars.
For Burke, it's been a lifelong love affair with the water.
Florida Bay was basically the Garden of Eden. Nearshore waters were beautiful, filled with sponges and all kinds of sea life, and you could go snorkeling right off your dock, and it was beautiful. It looked like just endless fields of emerald green, deep, rich, dark grass, filled with life, filled with stone crabs and lobsters and seahorses and octopuses and just all kinds of sea life, turtles. Everything was very near shore, and it was beautiful.
But it's not the seahorses or turtles that bring people to Florida Bay. It's the fish and the chance to chase them.
You have clean water. You have extensive amounts of shallow water. Florida Bay is just covered with flats and little entrances to islands and so much shallow water, so it really provides an interesting place to actually sight fish, where you actually see a fish and cast to it, opposed to just putting a bait out on the line and sitting on the bottom waiting for something to happen.
Saltwater fly fishing was basically invented on Florida Bay, and it was a good living for local guides and a passion for fishermen from around the world. Then in the late 1980s, 20,000 acres of seagrass on the bottom of the bay died off. That was followed by algae blooms. It was all too much, and the bay ecosystem collapsed. Along with it, so did much of the sport fishing on Florida Bay. That collapse helped make the case for Everglades restoration. 15 years after the federal plan to fix the Everglades, the bay has largely recovered. But last summer, fishermen and scientists started seeing worrying signs of a relapse. An estimated 50,000 acres of seagrass are dying or have died in the bay. For longtime guides like Burke, it's a nightmare rerun from the late 1980s.
My big fear is that I don't think we've seen the worst of it yet.
That's Steve Friedman. He wasn't fishing the waters of Florida Bay back then, but he has heard the stories. Today, he's a fishing guide on the bay, and this seagrass die-off worries him.
I think that when we come to the following summer, a lot of this grass that's still around and the grass that's not there is going to cause some worse problems and algae blooms and things like that, where these fish just don't want to be anywhere near that water.
Where there's no fish, there's no fishing. And where the fish go is where the fishing guides have to go with their paying clients.
It's putting pressure on other areas now where there are fish out in the Gulf of Mexico, closer to the Keys. I've been finding that there are a lot more boats in areas that wouldn't necessarily have as many boats as there are now. You can't spread out as much.
Scientists say the fix is the same goal that they've been recommending all along: get more clean, fresh water to Florida Bay. That's one of the major goals of the 15-year-old Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan.
The problem with Everglades restoration is that to really have an impact, you got to kind of reach critical mass. And we're still a long way from that critical mass.
Jerry Lorenz is the research director of Audubon Florida. He works out of Audubon's Tavernier Science Center, just down the street from Tad Burke's dock. Lorenz says some Everglades restoration projects have helped deliver more water to the bay, but that doesn't work when there's a drought, and he's frustrated at the repeating cycle of problems in all of the coastal estuaries that are part of the Everglades ecosystem. A drought causes a seagrass die-off in Florida Bay because not enough fresh water means the bay gets too salty. Then, when the heavy rains come, polluted water from Lake Okeechobee is released to the east and the west to protect the Hoover Dike. That creates problems for the Indian River Lagoon on the east coast and the west coast, where the Caloosahatchee River water winds up emptying into the Gulf of Mexico.
These stopgap measures are what's killing Florida Bay, Caloosahatchee Estuary, Indian River Lagoon. Until we recognize that that is all one problem, we're not going to get it fixed. You can't fix one of these problems. You have to fix them all. And until that concept of complete Everglades restoration is driven home, we're going to keep doing this.
The tourism economy of the Upper and Middle Keys relies on a healthy bay. The clear blue water is what tourists come to see. And there's the commercial fishing industry of the Keys. It's bigger here than anywhere else in the state. Even though commercial fishing is banned from Everglades National Park, the bay still plays an important role in the entire Keys ecosystem, including the coral reef just a few miles offshore in the Atlantic.
Florida Bay forms the kind of connection between the mangrove environments of the southern part of the Florida Peninsula and the coral reef tract. And it's an integral part to the health of the entire system.
Jim Forkran runs the Marine Education Research Initiative in the Keys for Florida International University. He's been studying the bay since he was a grad student in the 1980s.
A lot of the animals that shelter on coral reefs have juvenile stages that live in the seagrass meadows. A lot of the economically important species that are harvested in South Florida, things like lobsters and stone crab and shrimp, have juvenile forms that grow up in seagrass meadows. So the flow of individual animals as well as nutrients and other chemicals through the landscape depends on the presence of healthy seagrasses.
Forkran, like Burke, the longtime fishing guide, has been through the cycle of a Florida Bay collapse, and now he is watching his students experience it.
In 1988-89, I felt ill when I saw this beautiful place change. And it took 15 or 20 years for it to come back to what it used to look like in the early 1980s. When the seagrass die-off started again this past summer, the people that hadn't been in the system for very long felt just as sick to their stomach as I did back in 1990. They saw this beautiful place that they knew turning without understanding why. And in their experience, this was an unprecedented change, but that's only because they weren't here in 1987.
For those who are here, like Tad Burke, waiting for Everglades restoration to deliver real benefits to Florida Bay is getting more and more difficult.
So it's very difficult to watch the deterioration of Florida Bay leading to a deterioration of our fishery and then still try to be optimistic about the future.
This makes it very difficult for us to make a living, and also it's very disheartening. You know, a human lifespan is not even hardly a blink of an eye. And in barely the blink of an eye, we have seen an ecosystem that was robust and healthy and full of life deteriorate to basically being on life support.
Fishing guides, local officials, and environmentalists from groups like Audubon and the Everglades Foundation all agree on one thing. Saving the bay, again, will require a renewed commitment to Everglades restoration. That, they say, is the only way Florida Bay will get the clean, fresh water it needs to remain one of the world's finest fishing grounds and an economic incubator for the entire region. I'm Nancy Klinginer in Isla Mirada.
Still to come on our program, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers commander overseeing fixing the Everglades.
The policy that guides us in an ecosystem restoration project is a little bit is significantly different. In doing, say, a navigation project where we're dredging Port Everglades. And so the difference is that the benefits only need to equal the cost. It doesn't have to be net positive.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening today. We're talking about the Everglades. It's a big area and a big subject. Earlier, we visited where the Everglades area begins in South Florida, the Hoover Dyke along the south rim of Lake Okeechobee. And then we went south, out on Florida Bay, where the wetland drains into the ocean. The mix of organizations and agencies involved in the Everglades is about as complex as the ecosystem itself. You've got the South Florida Water Management District, the National Park Service, Fish and Wildlife, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, the U.S. Department of Environmental Protection, the Federal Departments of Transportation, Justice, and Agriculture, the Miccosukee and Seminole Tribes, and there's more. From the headwaters of the Glades south to Florida Bay, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is the lead federal agency on the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, SERP, a 30-year-plus project. It's now 15 years old and has doubled from its original cost, according to the update from the Corps to Congress just this month. It's a massive ecosystem restoration project where the Corps doesn't conduct its usual financial cost-benefit analysis. It's judged instead on its environmental benefits.
The benefits only need to equal the cost.
That's Colonel Jason Kirk, commander of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Jacksonville District.
It doesn't have to be net positive. The burden is different because
there's not a multiplier effect that you need to have.
Right, right. And that's there's a fundamental challenge of monetizing natural ecological benefits.
This is significantly different than, say, a navigation project such as dredging a port, where the Corps looks to create more economic value than by its spending to change the environment. We spoke with Colonel Kirk in our studios.
Colonel Kirk, describe the Corps' Everglades responsibility.
The Army Corps of Engineers, specific to the Everglades, has been engaged for many years. I'll go back to the signature agreement in 2000, the year 2000, when the state and the federal government, through the Army Corps of Engineers, entered into the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Project. And so now today, Everglades restoration remains a federal priority. It is the by percentage, highest percentage supported aquatic ecosystem restoration project in our nation for and speaking to the value of this unique ecosystem.
When you mean the highest supported, you mean the highest financially supported?
That's right. That's right. The Everglades, and just looking at 2016 and now in 2017, President Obama's budget request puts forth about 30% of the nation's aquatic ecosystem restoration budget requests, 30% towards the Everglades, higher than any other project.
What is the Corps' highest priority when it comes to its responsibilities regarding the Everglades?
Regarding the Everglades, the purpose of the Everglades is aquatic ecosystem restoration. So it is the restoration of the environment. You're looking at prior to flows that were adjusted, where the principal efforts back in the 1948 Central and South Florida project were fundamentally about flood risk management. That was the number one driver of the 1948 effort. Now, with the 2000 and beyond effort, the primary effort is restoration. With that said, Tom, it's important to note that there's also the imperative to maintain the water supply commitments and maintain the flood risk management benefits of the system while restoring the system. And when we talk about this restoration, sometimes we'll say we're trying to get the water right. And getting the water right, that's about quality, quantity, timing, and distribution. So how much of it, how clean is it, when does it move, and where does it move? Those are all the elements that are being attended to in this restoration effort.
It also speaks to all the stakeholders with the Everglades restoration generally, but also the stakeholders when it comes to water in South Florida. So how does the Corps balance those stakeholders in this effort, public safety being one of them, and we're going to talk about the Hoover Dam Rehabilitation Project, recreation, of course, and fishing. There's the environmental aspects, there's real estate protection with flood control, and then, of course, the agriculture industry as well, Colonel.
Well, it is a balance, as you said. It's important to note that the effort that we're undertaking with SERP is a state-federal partnership. That element specifically, and it's cost-shared 50-50 between the state and federal government for the project elements for which we've signed agreements. We're committed to, and I would tell you the partnership is strong between the state, usually represented by the South Florida Water Management District, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Jacksonville District. And the public does and should interface both with South Florida Water Management District, their elected state legislators, as well as their federal representatives, to keep both the state and federal agencies responsive to that which the public is looking for.
Is there a matrix that's used or some kind of formula that's used as you are looking at projects to balance those demands and desires for sometime what can be countervailing stakeholders? Agriculture would like a certain amount of water at a certain time, and of course recreational sport fishermen in Florida Bay would like more water but want to make sure it's clean as well.
Right. And so we're always evaluating both the benefits and the costs. And it starts with the fundamental premise that this is a restoration effort. So we're looking at the benefits gained in our flexibility with water distribution, improvements to water quality, and that's in the multiple directions. So you may appreciate the challenge we have right now because the system does not allow us to move as much water south as we envision in the ultimate plan. So with that limiting factor right now, we move water in great quantities both east and west when it's burdening the Lake Okeechobee Dike. And we do not have as many options in so doing. So good news that's in the works is we have off-canal reservoirs that are being built both to the east, the C-44 reservoir, that will give us some options before water is shunted out to tide and out to the estuaries, where they can take some amount of fresh water, but it's at times not as much as we're sending. And then similarly to the west, down the Caloosahatchee, there's a reservoir complex that South Florida is building to also give us options in the system.
There's been a lot of concentration around where the Everglades ecosystem in South Florida at least begins, right at that Hoover Dike, that interface between Lake Okeechobee and the Everglades agricultural area. The Hoover Dike is undergoing a rehabilitation program, as we've reported on. Is the dike safer today in advance of another wet season than it was a year ago?
Every element of construction helps, but they're because we still have gaps, the short answer is no. We're not much safer today than we were a year ago, but every element does help get us towards that. There are very clearly identified weak points in the system, and it's important to note that we have worked on and are almost complete with what's called a dam safety modification study that helps give the answers to the what specific things need to be done along the perimeter of the dike. Again, looking at benefits and costs to pick the most valuable construction elements. As we look at that document that's almost finalized, We're looking at an additional investment of about $700 million.
This is on top of the
that's on top of the $700 million that's already been extended to take a structure, as your listeners will appreciate, that was first built to not very well-defined standards following the 1928 floods. Some of that structure is still what we're going back and bringing to 21st century standards. And so we have a well-defined plan. We're looking forward to being able to finalize that. We think about August of this year. And at that point, we'll have a path forward, subject to the annual appropriations, a path forward to build that out and allow us then to operate the lake with less risk as the current schedule directs us.
Would it allow you, the Corps, which is responsible for setting the lake level at Lake Okeechobee, would it allow the Corps to set a lake level that is higher than it is set at today? Those lake levels, as you know, were reduced after Hurricane Katrina and the review of the entire levee system in the United States, including the Hoover Dike. Will it allow a larger capacity of a reservoir that Lake Okeechobee could be?
Tom, what completing the dam safety mod study and now the work directed in the study will allow us to evaluate the lake schedule and evaluate a range of options now informed by a dike that is safer. And then we will do a revisit of the Lake Okeechobee regulation schedule that was drafted in a very public process in 2008 and revisit that. And just as we do any study effort, we're going to be looking at that with multiple project purposes.
So it's possible it could hold more water than it does today.
It is possible that it could hold more water, but that is not necessarily going to be the outcome. When we look at the options, we'll be, again, looking at the totality of benefits and cost. The biodiversity, the wildlife impacts at different lake stages, the water supply considerations at different lake stages, and in all of that, we will get towards, I suspect, a somewhat different Lake Okeechobee regulation schedule, but maybe not that much different. Again, what will be different is the risk of a catastrophic failure to the residents of Clewiston and other areas south of the lake. That will be much less. That's what the federal taxpayers are paying for right now.
When it comes to the Hoover Dike, as you've previously mentioned, it's very difficult to move that water south. When the lake level rises, when there is an historic downpour in December and January, for instance, that we had in late 2015 and earlier this year, when we're approaching another wet season, another storm season, the fastest way to reduce the lake level is to the east and the west. And we've seen the environmental and ecological damage that those fast releases have done in those watershed areas. The issue becomes the ability to store water. Storing water also allows the potential of cleaning the water as well. What's the feasibility of an aquifer storage program, not having reservoirs carved out of the crust of the earth like we've done in the past, but being able to inject it under the earth and then being able to get it back out and direct it and redirect it in a way that is more environmentally friendly and more addressing the kind of supply side of the water demand?
Great question, Tom. And we've spent a lot of time studying that component. It's titled Aquifer Storage Recovery, ASR, as some of your folks may know it. And that was, I would say, a prominent feature. It was a significant feature highlighted in the original study document in 2000. The effort to look at the feasibility of that has informed us that it certainly won't solve the storage effort by itself. And we think that it's about a two-third decrease in capacity of what was originally envisioned. So
only about a third of what was originally planned for 16 years ago is feasible going forward.
That's right, throughout the expanse. So that's the initial estimate. And we have done, and South Florida Water Management District has, a couple of pilot ASR wells that are in operation now, actually were used in February, early March, as an option, small capacity, but important to have some other option, as you said. You can appreciate This January, we had 9.13 inches on the Lake Okeechobee system, highest ever recorded. I looked at the records. You probably looked at the records back to 1932, highest ever. So the fact that we used that one little ASR well to the south was a good effort. But we need other options.
And those other options are going to be reservoirs, as you mentioned. Part of the SERP calls for reservoirs. Those reservoirs take land. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is not in the business of purchasing land for reservoirs, is it?
The state of Florida has the imperative, the responsibility to acquire the lands that then become part of the Everglades restoration, not the federal government.
So with this feasibility study that looked at the ability of using underground storage and coming up with essentially a third of what had originally been planned for, how does that expand the need for reservoir storage?
Right. So those acre feet need to be accounted for somewhere in the water balance. And that's absolutely how we're looking at, have been, but are into the future, looking at the individual project elements that are in our integrated delivery schedule and taking those from a schedule that goes out from now till 2032, but very importantly, laying those on a map and then looking dimensionally at the volumetric capacity, the storage that you're talking about, and making sure there's enough in the plan to get it the necessary amount to have the benefits, going back to our discussion about getting the water right, the QQTD, the quality, quantity, timing, and distribution, to make sure it's enough. So the short answer is we're looking at where will we find the land? What is the alternative now if some large element, 100,000 or more acre feet, will not come from ASR? Where is it going to come from? The state, the Corps are looking at that.
Let me ask you about dollars and cents here. Every 5 years, the Department of Interior comes up with a report to Congress about essentially a progress report. As you mentioned earlier, SERP, the 15-year plan where we're halfway into restoring the Everglades, aims to get water right. 15 years in, is it getting the water right?
It is getting the water more right. It absolutely is. And we're early into it, though. We are early into it. So if you go up to, as I was able to do last week, to the Kissimmee River, you see an almost completed restoration. We still have some significant features left to do as we take that what was once a straightened canal that very quickly shunted water, somewhat nutrient-laden water, straight into Lake Okeechobee. We're restoring that watershed to a natural, gradual flow path, and much of that work is done. If you go south and west, the western Everglades, as it's sometimes called, the Picayune Strand, we have two of the three pump stations complete. Water's now moving south through spreader canals, and it's working its way through natural sheet flow, and those are restoration benefits achieved. So we are making progress that you can go out, get in an airboat, have binoculars, and look at it. And it's important for stakeholders to know that. We're not there yet, but the water is more right than it was yesterday, and it's going to be more right tomorrow. And we've got to keep on the effort, keep up the momentum, the positive momentum that this federal-state partnership has gotten us on.
That momentum is going to take more money in the future, as you know, Colonel. This five-year report card acknowledged that the costs continue rising for the Central Everglades Restoration Project. In 2000, the total cost of the whole plan was just over $8 billion. Now it's about twice that. According to the report, it's counted for via inflation, not necessarily scope of project changes, that most of the increase is because of inflation. But the rate of inflation is relatively low, and I don't want to get into the arcane financial math of inflation figuring, but what is accounting for that cost of inflation? Is it the cost of labor? Is it the cost of materials? Is it the cost of fuel? Is it the cost of land? What is it in that inflation that has essentially doubled the cost of this program?
There is there is an inflation factor, a significant inflation factor compounded by some scope changes. Part of a central premise of this effort, when I started out, Tom, we were talking about a unique ecosystem and a restoration effort like no other in the world. And so undergirding that is this idea of adaptive management. We will learn as we go. In some cases, we figured out we need other pieces. We need other pieces that maybe cost more. So features to protect manatees, for example, from coming in from Florida Bay into the southern expanse. That's just one example.
Colonel, what is that return on investment for this community, for the region of South Florida, and for the Jacksonville district of which you command?
Right. Well, and it's important to note that it is broad benefits that ultimately, with the economic impacts and value of the South Florida economy, that it's a national enterprise. It's a national enterprise that's important because of this unique ecosystem. What you will get, what are the benefits? The improved health of Lake Okeechobee. So the water in Lake Okeechobee and the water going out of Lake Okeechobee will have less of a nutrient load. That's a benefit. Therefore, the fresh water releases to the estuaries, they'll be both decreased. That's a benefit. And the water that goes out will be cleaner. That's a benefit. The water delivery to Florida and Biscayne Bays will be cleaner. And as well, the water and increased water that'll get to Florida and Biscayne Bay has a value in helping address sea level rise, because as you appreciate, part of the manifestation of sea level rise is the saltwater intrusion can now creep further in, both subsurface and surface. A saltwater lens can intrude into the landmass. By having more fresh water delivered to Florida and Biscayne Bay, you're pushing that lens out, and so that helps protect the coastline and improves water quality throughout the system, and then enhances water supply, doesn't waste water to tide, is some of your listeners will appreciate. If we rush water down the C-111 canal through South Dade, or we rush water down the St. Lucie, out the St. Lucie estuary, we rush water down the Caloosahatchee past Fort Myers, and all of that, it's essentially wasted to tide. The Everglades restoration enhances water supply while also, and very importantly, while also maintaining flood protection.
Colonel Jason Kirk, commander of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Jacksonville District, where he leads the Corps' oversight of the multi-decade, multi-billion-dollar Everglades restoration. Still to come in our program, the Empire of the Everglades and the pestilence-ridden swamp.
If Governor Broward and the state of Florida hadn't done the drainage in, 1906, or started the project in 1906, Dade County and Palm Beach County and Broward County would be completely different, look completely different than what they are today.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening today. We've been talking about the Everglades system, from the Hoover Dyke around Lake Okeechobee down to the shallow waters of the Florida Bay. It's an ecosystem from which the South Florida economy was carved. The agriculture, real estate, and tourism industries of today owe much of their existence to the 19th and 20th centuries' ambition to dominate the American landscape. It was a riverboat captain from Jacksonville who led the charge to drain the wetlands to create what he called the Empire of the Everglades.
During the early part of the 20th century, the edge of the Everglades was only a few blocks west of this building.
This is part of the permanent display at the Fort Lauderdale Historical Society on the second floor of the New River Inn.
In 1904, Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Broward was elected on a platform that included Everglades drainage.
Governor Broward promised to create his Empire of the Everglades, running his 1904 gubernatorial gubernatorial campaign on a populist, progressive platform. Progressive politics were in favor. Teddy Roosevelt was president of the United States, and he had been using antitrust law to break up corporate monopolies, especially railroads. Napoleon Bonaparte Broward from Jacksonville ran as the alternative candidate to the, quote, land-grabbing railroads, and his two opponents for the Democratic nomination for governor who supported those railroads.
He was actually not the first person to actually come up with the idea. The idea actually dates back to the 1880s, but it just never got the push on the state level until Broward, you know, was elected. It was one of his campaign plaques was to drain the Everglades.
Todd Bothell is the deputy director, supervising curator at the Fort Lauderdale Historical Society. The society has an exhibit focused on Governor Broward's role in the development of the Everglades. Now today, when we talk about Everglades restoration, it's not turning back what began with Governor Broward's election in 1904. Broward's interest, like any governor, was to grow the state. In his case, that meant tackling the bottom third of Florida.
Basically, at that point, everything south of Lake Okeechobee was swampland. You know, we're at the turn of the 20th century, and he's looking at, you know, expanding, you know, land in the state. So we've got, you know, a third or half of the state basically underwater. So that's why he was kind of on that, you know, as part of his campaign, was to drain the Everglades, to, you know, create more land, you know, be able to bring more people into the state, which obviously will bring more tax money and revenue and all that kind of stuff.
It was arguably Broward's number one priority of his administration. Special districts were set up, financial incentives were established, and dredging of the first canal began. Crews worked south from Lake Okeechobee and northwest from Fort Lauderdale. In 1912, the crews met, and the first vein draining the Everglades was completed. Broward's goal of opening South Florida for people, business, and agriculture certainly worked. It's only in the past few decades the environmental value and cost of achieving that goal has been acknowledged.
Back then, you know, the main emphasis was, you know, getting land available to do farming and development. They weren't, you know, at that point, weren't really concerned about environmental concerns.
What do you think, if anything, Governor Broward and his contemporaries would say about the kind of debate that we're still having about the Everglades?
If I had to guess, Governor Broward, he might not have an understanding of the environmental impacts. His goal was, you know, to make the state. And, you know, if I drain the swamp and create land, I'm going to create economic opportunities for the people, you know, moving into those areas and, you know, create economic impact on our state. If you look at it today, if Governor Broward and the state of Florida hadn't done the drainage in, you know, 1906 or started the project in 1906, and we hadn't done any of the canals, I mean, Dade County and Palm Beach County and Broward County would be completely different, look completely different than what they are today.
Wanda Miles is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
In the Everglades, there's a way of life. It's a way of peace without stress or strife. There's a fellow there who protects these rights. Lincoln Vale of the Everglades, the man on patrol in the Everglades. Moving ever, moving through the Everglades. Moving ever, moving through the Everglades. Moving ever, moving, moving ever, moving through the Everglades.